It's the 3rd of May 2013, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Do Bangladeshi bloggers have more to worry about than the people in the comments section? Could synthetic biology make dealing drugs easier? And what happened at the Pythagorean cabaret? And do both sides of the story add up to the square of the hypotenuse? Do you see what they did there? But before we begin, the begging slot. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. We really do appreciate all donations as they help us keep paying the server bills and that sort of thing. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, everyone knows that piracy is ruining video games. That's why I'm worried about the next Assassin's Creed game. But how can games developers demonstrate the damage of piracy to the average gamer? This week, Liz Luckendorf has been speaking to Patrick Klug from Greenheart Games, who are behind the new Game Dev Tycoon game, who have come up with a rather novel solution.
Can you explain what your game is about and what you did to make the headlines that we have read over here?
Okay, yes. The game is called Game Dev Tycoon. It's for Game Developer Tycoon. And basically, you replay gaming history as a game developer. So it's a bit of an inception thing because you are playing a game developer who develops games and then sells them in your virtual world. And you are basically running a game development company. And the reason why we made headlines recently is that we had quite a unique way of dealing, dealing with piracy. Initially, the question was actually, how do we even deal with piracy? Every game development company needs to ask this question. We knew as gamers that we hated copy protection, so DRM that is usually used to restrict how you use a game and how you can install it. Usually just annoys the gamers, so we didn't want to do that. But on the same time, we knew that on the first day, our game would be pirated. So the idea was, okay, if this is the case, then maybe we can control that experience somehow. And then we basically just did some brainstorming. And after a while, we kind of had this idea that, well, we are actually creating a game development simulator. So maybe we can use that to not just tell, the pirates, oh, you're using a pirated version, but to actually make them feel how it is to be the victim of piracy. So what happens is as these pirates play a cracked version that we have adjusted specifically for that, they will slowly be hit by piracy and the virtual game company goes bankrupt because of piracy.
Was there much debate over whether to release directly to the pirates?
I think the idea that we would release some version fairly quickly because we wanted to know exactly how many people would use the pirated version. And we can only do that if we release a slightly different version where we can separate it from the normal one. So that idea was very quickly. And then, we had some ideas about saying, okay, maybe we show a banner saying this is pirated, please buy me, or any of that sort. And as I found out later, games have done that before, so that would have not been unique. And in the end, though, we decided that we want to do what I just said before. And I think the unique thing is that we don't tell the player that this is a pirated version. So the only way they find out is either they're smart enough to see the irony in what is happening and say, okay, I actually pirated the game and now the game is showing me that. Or it happened and it was, I think that's really what the story made it so big, is that people went and even in lost support forums and basically complained that piracy is ruining them, which is quite ironic because, they are ruining other companies. So I think that's was really the kicker that made it big.
What sort of reaction have you had now? I guess you've had a bigger pool of people who may have downloaded, but what has been the reaction from people who found out that they've played the pirated games and other people as well?
From the people that I know of who have discovered that they found out that, they played the pirated game, I think some of them actually wrote us and excused, said they're sorry, and then just bought the game. I think that was actually the most common reaction of the people who identified themselves, which surprised me that they would identify themselves and saying, okay, I did pirate it, but I saw your blog post and I have bought it now, which is absolutely fantastic. But of course, every time piracy is discussed, it's this huge, pirates versus the other people. And I never wanted to be like this black and white thing. I personally believe that piracy is really an issue, but it's not like the big companies always say it's just damaging and you lose millions of dollars. I think that is not the issue. The issue is the culture itself and how that culture changes gaming itself. Because as we see a trend to free-to-play and social games more and more, you know, some gamers like me don't really like those games. I think they are of a different type of game, and I enjoy more the traditional kind. And the reason this trend appears, though, is because games are pirated. So publishers are forced to go to free-to-play and different approaches, or always online and that kind of thing. So I hope that this kind of thing is more in the, you know, in the mind of some users.
It's kind of, I find the interesting story that being you're an independent developer, and like the graph you had on your blog about the 93% of people who are pirating, what's it like being an independent developer? Is that like a barrier to you wanting to continue to develop, or do you have to make a game, have it successful, and then be hired by a company who has, you know, the millions of dollars to deal with this?
Well, if that would be the case, I think it's a sad state of the industry, because then never, you know, no one could actually shake up the industry by being successful on their own, and the bigger guys would always just get bigger. And I think there are not many independent developers who actually make it that big that they can afford to hire a few people. I mean, it's extremely expensive to develop games. And the other thing is that piracy, you know, it's not just... Did this? A lot of pirates say, "Okay, this 93% is not realistic, because if we wouldn't have released it on this pirates tracker, then probably half of them would have never found out about our game." And I think it's a fair comment, but also it's just so depressing that people who genuinely play your game, no matter how they found out, just don't pay for it. You know, you need so many more people, and it's not like it doesn't affect you. It makes it different. If 10,000 people play your game, you will need support staff. Maybe you will need much more energy to deal with your community. And everyone just thinks, oh, yeah, that's okay. You know, if 10,000 people pirate your game, then maybe 100 buy it. I don't think that's a fair comment.
What is the market like for indie games? I guess I'm quite guilty in buying loads of stuff off Xbox Live and playing Bioshock and all this stuff. I guess it's easy and it's there and they tell me it's there and I buy it. How hard is it for you to get a name for a game that's independently developed? This is kind of interesting, as I guess the media has helped you a little bit, but what's it like?
I would have to say I don't know, because we were lucky. This was an absolute, like, we didn't plan that. Some accuse us that this was a marketing ploy for us to get publicity, and it was not. I mean, it's, believe it or not, we didn't realize the potential, I guess. So we were extremely lucky to have that kind of publicity and to get people to see our game. Because the game actually had been released on the Windows Store for 4 months beforehand. This was our release of the native version, that is for Windows 7, Mac and Linux. And up there, you know, we had some exposure, but it was really difficult to get to a point where we could survive to make another game. So I think marketing in itself is a big problem in the industry. You know, if only 1% or 3% buy your game, you need so much marketing power to get to this amount of people that this is an issue, I think.
Well, I feel better now because I have a Mac, so I couldn't have played it before. So this is good.
Yeah, and I wanted to add, you know, how many independent developers people know that made it, you know, bigger than just one, two guys? I personally only know Notch, really, from Minecraft fame. And, you know, if it takes such a genius idea to be successful, then something is wrong. Because, you know, our game, for example, is not a genius idea. It was inspired by a different game. We tried to make it our own, make it better, and so on and so forth. But it shouldn't be the case that you have that you can only afford to live a normal life as an independent developer if you make a genius super hit. Like, there needs to be some market for just okay games that are fun to play. And what we see as well is that people do enjoy the game, even though it's not perfect. So I think there is really an issue with piracy that just removes this layer completely, where people cannot succeed if they're not absolutely over the top good.
And as you said, it's not good for the industry itself not to have people to be able to break the mold, as it were, and come up with different games.
Yes, I think I find this the most frustrating, is that gamers complain about games that come out, about the attitude of big companies, about, you know, recent things like SimCity and always on requirements and stuff like that. But they don't seem to see that the reason why companies are forced to go into different directions and decide not just, you know, that DRM is necessary, but what type of game to make is because you can't create just a normal game easily and make money out of it.
And the most important question I could possibly ask, because those are all the questions I have, where can people go buy your game?
On greenheartgames.com, that's our website. And there are a couple of buttons. As I said, it's just $8. It's DRM-free, so you can install it on all your personal machines and play it. And yeah, we would very much welcome you to our community and for you to support us, because we would like to bring you more single-player games that are not online and do not have social aspects or require you to buy coins.
Brilliant. And we'll put links up to buy the game from the Pod Delusion website and give it a great review, because we were both obsessively playing it last night. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Yeah, it was good to chat.
Now, how much do we really know about North Korea? In a few weeks' time, the Soho Skeptics, of which the Pod Delusion is a part, are putting on a talk by journalist and North Korea watcher Alistair Coleman all about the secretive state. You can find links to buy tickets on the Pod Delusion website, but to find out more, I had a chat with Alistair. I started by asking him if the media portrayals of the country, with the military parades and the big statues of Kim Il-sung, are in any way actually reflective of what it's like there.
It more or less is, yes. I mean, it's a very military-driven country. I mean, the problem we have in the West is that our perception of North Korea is coloured greatly by things like Team America. And so I don't like to say the lunacy of the regime is played up a lot, because they seem to think they know what they're doing. But it's very much coloured by the military's first policies that they have.
Do you think that the sort of eccentricities that we see, do the people there know that it's a bit eccentric, like the leadership, or do they know that it's all part of, I guess, like the controlling 1984 style thing?
Not at all. They only know what they're told. It's an entirely state-controlled media. Radios and televisions come pre-tuned. All the news is essentially written. All they see is propaganda all the time. So they only know what they're told, and to them that's perfectly normal.
It's part of your job. You spend a lot of time monitoring North Korean television, I understand. What's it actually like? I mean, do they have soap operas and things, or is it all just propaganda?
You could say that there is an awful lot of propaganda in there. I've never actually seen a soap. There's a lot of films which are of an intensely patriotic nature. There's children's programs, as you'd expect, and extraordinarily long films of Kim Jong-un visiting military facilities and the like.
What's the production standards? Do these things stand up, or is it... Because, you know, in my head, I think sort of wobbly sets and stuff. Are the films any good?
A lot of the films are 1950s, 60s, 70s vintage and are not so good. But since Kim Jong-un came to power over a year ago, there has been a large change in the production standards in North Korean television. There's new newsreaders, there's new backdrop, there's more video reports. So standards have greatly improved.
So I take it they've not got HD yet?
No, they haven't.
So the reason we've put on this talk at Soho Skeptics and invited you to come and speak, and the reason I want to talk to you today is because obviously in the news recently there's been a hell of a lot of saber rattling on their part. What strikes me as unusual about North Korea, I mean, given all this, is there doesn't seem to actually be sort of any internal opposition or any organised opposition. If you look at, say, Syria or Iran or other baddies, if you will, there's opposition groups, there's sympathetic groups we can go, yeah, we should support the good guys. In North Korea, is there any of that?
No, there isn't. But what we have got instead are power struggles between, say, the Workers' Party of Korea and the military. And that's essentially what we're seeing now, is it's military-driven saber-rattling, and Kim Jong-un is essentially choosing to go along with the military at the moment rather than with the party.
As he's just a kid, is he making these decisions, or is he just a puppet?
He's not really a kid. He's 30 or 31. We're not quite sure of his age. There are rumoured to be, you could say, eminence grise there. There's Kim Jong-il's sister, who's seemed to be the power behind the throne, also her husband.
Ah, okay. So if, for example, tomorrow SEAL Team 6 were to drop down and put a bullet into Kim Jong-un, which I think is very unlikely...
I think that too.
Would the sister take over? Because the thing, and this is just me speculating aloud now, so I could be talking utter nonsense, is because the whole personality cult is around the Kim family, would, if there wasn't a Kim to take the place, would...
I would not be surprised if there was another senior family member who would immediately take over. It's very difficult to tell what the... I mean, it's almost like royalty. I mean, it's what the line to the throne is. But I would imagine that would happen. Kim Jong-un himself is known to have one, possibly two children, but they are still very young, preschool age.
I guess the other question to ask, I'm a bit of a nerd for this sort of thing, and the thing I find fascinating is how they got to the point where it is this sort of all-encompassing personality cult. Would you be able to shed any insight on how it went from... Because I imagine in sort of just after World War II, when, you know, the Russians were occupying North Korea, the people didn't immediately just... It wasn't they woke up one day and Kim Il-sung was... the all-glorious God. How did they create that sort?
Well, it goes back before that. So let's say it's about 1910, when Japan essentially annexed the whole Korean Peninsula into its empire. And then in 1945, at the end of the Second World War, Russia and the United States essentially did what they did in Germany. They partitioned the country into its own sectors. America didn't really have much of an idea what to do with the South because it was just seen as something out on the periphery of Asian politics, which they didn't really have a lot of interest in. So they installed their man, who turned out to be a complete dictator. Whilst Russia, they installed Kim Il-sung, who was the leader of the guerrillas and against the Japanese, and essentially was the top communist person in the country.
Looking at, say, other communist regimes... they've not really had the same sort of culty sort of thing. I mean, my understanding is it's all to do with the is it pronounced juice?
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's it. Military first industrialization in which everything in the country is geared toward feeding a huge standing army of over 1 million people. I mean, it's a country of 25 million. The army's over 1 million, and that's an awful lot of mouths to feed. And an awful lot of equipment to purchase or manufacture. So essentially, it's basically the peasant classes there paying the price of having to supply a huge army to essentially do nothing.
It's terrifying to think they've got that many people and it's such a dodgy regime. So I guess that the final question to ask, and I imagine this is what a lot of people listening will be wanting to know, is it likely there's going to be a war? I know you're not of that opinion.
My opinion is a very short one. The answer is no. A slightly longer opinion is that it's all political. It's North Korea throwing a strop to get some bargaining chips against the United States. And you have to look back to last year when they made an agreement with the US in which they were going to get 250,000 tons of food aid. And then they decided they're going to launch satellites and set off nuclear weapons and lost that food aid. And now they're trying to get it back.
Could this spill over? Because, you know, I just worry that all of these different provocations, the reneging on treaties, saying they're now in a state of war, could they just tip things over into a bit, sort of an awkward spiral of everyone getting angry?
Well, you are absolutely right. I mean, the thing is, they've reneged on these treaties before and they've been in a state of war since June 1950. But, I mean, there's always a chance that somebody will do something silly and press the wrong button and before you know it, there's an invasion happening or bombs going off somewhere.
But we shouldn't worry about that.
But don't worry about that. It's never going to happen.
Brilliant. Well, we'll leave there. We'll put links to buy a ticket to your talk on the Pod Delusion website. It's been fascinating talking to you, Alistair. Thank you very much. Now, as you may know, in this country, attacking religion and religious organisations is more or less fine. But around the world, this isn't always the case. This week, Bob Churchill, who works for the International Humanist and Ethical Union, or IHEU, brings us the news of what's happening in Bangladesh, where 84 bloggers are facing threats from Islamists for daring to advocate a secular worldview. The sound on this next piece is a little bit distorted, but it's very important, so pay attention. Here's Bob, explaining more.
Last week, a textiles building collapsed in Dhaka, killing hundreds of workers. The disaster prompted accusations of a callous disregard for workers' safety and more generally drew attention to the poor working conditions with poor pay faced by Bangladeshi workers in factories supplying cheap goods to stores around the world. The building collapse has been reported globally and drew an estimated 20,000 protesters to the main rally in Dhaka yesterday. This cause is serious and the hurt keenly felt and reflected around the world. And yet the figure of 20,000 protesting in connection with the building collapse is at least five times lower than the 100,000, that's the conservative estimates, some reports say hundreds of thousands, who marched a few weeks earlier in April. This huge protest, led by Jamaat-e Islami and other Islamist parties and groups, demanded a new blasphemy law with a sentence of capital punishment aimed at atheist bloggers and secular activists. This prospect was, one can only imagine, particularly terrifying for the four atheist bloggers already languishing in prison, accused of hurting religious sensibilities, and who even now are still detained. The four atheist bloggers, Subrata, Mashia, Razel, and the popular writer and activist Asif Mohiuddin, were first locked up several weeks ago. As so often the case when blasphemy and religious offence are on the cards, when you dig beneath the headlines, there is complexity and politics very close to the surface. The bloggers are part of a secular youth movement, Shabag, named for a city location, a bit like Tahrir Square, defending Bangladesh's secular constitution against Islamist opposition parties and advocating for justice over war crimes committed during the War of Independence in 1971. It was as the trials of two leading members of Jamaat came to a head in February that resentment and violence broke out. Some Shabag protesters demanded that the Islamist party Jamaat be banned, as it has been in the past, as a threat to secularism and to democracy itself. Some even demanded that Islamist leaders found guilty of wartime atrocities should receive the maximum sentence for such crimes, which under Bangladeshi law is death. Jamaat's reaction to the verdicts and these demands for harsher sentences was fierce. They demanded that it was the bloggers who organized or supported Shabag who should be put to death for being atheists and for hurting religious sentiments, insults which they equated with the very real atrocities and war crimes of 1971. At this point, human rights organizations, including the International Humanist and Ethical Union, demanded that the bloggers be released. Atheism is not a crime, and certainly advocating for secularism and for justice, even if for many of us the death sentence is out of bounds, should not be outlawed. The bloggers were questioned as atheists on the charge of hurting religious sentiments, so this was clearly a freedom of religion or belief issue as well as a freedom of expression issue. The Shabag background means it is also political. Jamaat-e Islami wanted to silence its critics. At IHEU, we stressed that bending to the demands of Jamaat at this point was not a compromise worth making, rather it would be walking into a trap set by the fundamentalists. But when the Islamists presented a list of 84 bloggers to the authorities, government responded saying it would pursue the complaints. Jamaat demanded a blasphemy law. The Prime Minister has thankfully ruled this out, marking a limit under the secular constitution. But then she also said that existing laws are enough to prosecute bloggers if they have hurt religious sentiments. Another little concession, another little compromise. It was a trade-off. The rights of atheists, and anyone who has anything to say about religion or about the Islamist parties, traded off for the appearance of listening to Islamists, even though the demands being listened to grew increasingly outrageous. And of course, with a little taste of victory, the demands continued to inflate. 100,000 Islamists marched not only for blasphemy law with a death sentence, but for wider Jamaat-e Islami demands, the cancellation of the government's new women in education policy, state recognition of fundamentalist religious education, and so on. As the atheists languished in jail, the demands grew bolder. Now Jamaat threatens to march again on the 5th of May to lay siege to Dhaka. Today I joined in a leafleting protest outside the Bangladeshi High Commission in London. Around the world, humanist and atheist organizations have held protests both this week and last week, and IHEU has been encouraging groups and individuals to write to representatives in their country and their representatives in Bangladesh to argue that the government must stop flip-flopping, it must stick to its secular principles, defend freedom of expression and the freedom of thought of the non-religious. As Bangladeshi citizens, or those intended to travel there, came in and out of the consular section at the High Commission today, it struck me that several people proudly called themselves atheists, that most, as indeed is clearly the case in Bangladesh, were proud of their secular law, proud of their independence from Pakistan, which was described as a pious, fanatical neighbour. The siege rally planned for 5th of May was a genuine concern for most of those I spoke to. Leaders of the coalition of Islamist groups behind it have said both that it will be a peaceful protest, but also that we are prepared to martyr ourselves and that they would not leave until their demands were met. For the sake of the majority of Bangladeshis who support a secular state, the government must learn to stand on principle. The Islamists are trying to use religion to galvanize opposition, giving leeway to their hysteria and their outrageous and illiberal demands at the expense of freedom of thought and freedom of expression must stop now before the siege really sets in. This is Bob Churchill for the Pod Delusion.
So we've heard a lot recently about synthetic biology, the idea that in the future we'll be able to do lots of new, exciting, and possibly scary things by mucking around with genes, transplanting them into different organisms, engineering them to behave differently, and all that sort of thing. Playing gods in all but name, I guess. But what will it all actually mean? What sort of products will we actually see? And what will the implications be? Julie Gould has been speaking to David Benck at the Royal College of Art, who's been asking these questions and possibly figuring out how drug dealers in the future could use this technology to their advantage. Here's Julie with more.
Hello, I'm here with David Benke, who is from the Design Interactions Programme at the Royal College of Art. Now, David, can you tell me a little bit about what you do in this programme?
So I'm technically a research associate, but I also teach the synthetic biology project every year for the first year. The first year is basically divided into very small, brief projects, and we do the one about synthetic biology.
What is the purpose of the Design Interaction Programme? What sort of things do you look at when you're studying a subject like synthetic biology?
A way to summarise the approach is to say that we're looking at the implications of science and technology rather than the applications. So when you think about designers, you most likely think about people who are trying to make products. And so we're kind of taking design upstream to laboratories or to research that's not yet delivered. And the goal is to think about potential future products or future impact that these things could have on our lives. So societies, daily lives, culture, etc. So it's a lot more about triggering the imagination and getting people to ask questions, rather than kind of more traditional design, which is about finding solutions and products.
If you were to apply this to synthetic biology, what sort of things are you looking at there?
So for synthetic biology, it's kind of, you don't really have a choice because there are no real products out there yet. Some of them are starting to appear in like fuels and healthcare and things like that. We're more interested again in looking at these things in terms of what their impact might be and telling more unexpected stories about it than what's currently being broadcast in the media. You know, we're not looking to save the world. We're kind of looking at more ambiguous, maybe more nuanced stories as to how these things might play out.
Can you give me an example of one of these stories?
Well, the students at the RCA, again, have 4 weeks, so this is quite like short, kind of quick ideas. One of the things that came up last year was looking at bioremediation and the fact that there is traces of cocaine in London's water. So one student had the idea to set up a kind of black market ecosystems where algae and carps would be engineered to gather all these trace amounts of cocaine and possibly reintroduce them to a black market.
I mean, that's incredible.
There is a very wide range of projects, so this would be kind of maybe a more darker scenario. Some other things we're looking at: producing bioplastics from meat and carnivorous plants, and setting up cities around mushrooms. And
this carp and algae black market system that one of your students set up, what sort of questions is that asking?
It's questioning, again, bigger narratives of cleaning up the environment with bacteria and putting that in more specific contexts where you look at who would do it and why. Because often I think with these kind of potentially world-saving new discoveries, it's very one-sided. But actually, when science gets out of the lab, it gets into the hands of, you know, we're all complicated people with different needs, different ambitions or motivations. And so I guess it's all about, you know, focusing on that as an aspect of how these scientific things trickle down society. So he chose a certain angle in of a certain logic that these things could be picked up by the drug dealers themselves to kind of get some of their product back and maximize their profit. So again, choosing a very specific context for it helps flesh out these scenarios, and then it makes them more tangible, so you can, you know, you see a video with these things happening, so you can react and kind of decide what you think about it.
The people these questions are aimed at, are they the scientists who are doing the synthetic biology, or are they the public?
We work quite closely with the bioengineering department at Imperial College. It's next door, so some of the PhD students come and give tutorials to our design students. And that's probably when the best results appear, because when the students have kind of more grounding in the real science, their stories become more fleshed out and more believable. So that's one of the goals. So I would say that during the process, there is always a discussion with the scientist and the designer. And then once the project gets resolved and finished and has a tangible presence, whether it's a video or prototype or, you know, an object,
product.
Then it gets out and kind of reaches a wider public.
Why is it that you've used synthetic biology as a subject for inspiration?
Well, I guess synthetic biology is a buzzword at the moment, so it's very popular, and I guess, you know, this is for lots of different reasons, such as, you know, funding for scientific research, etc. These buzzwords tend to come and go, so, you know, nanotechnology is not as hot as it used to be, etc. But I guess for us it's really about the deeper questions that are within this field. So what's our relationship to life? Narratives of engineering, so the idea that we'd be able to somehow engineer life to suit our needs. And how is that different from the stuff we've been doing, for example, in agriculture through more traditional selective breeding techniques? So I guess we're really interested in these basic questions that are attached to this field rather than the buzzword in itself. If that makes sense.
The aim of your piece is then to communicate these questions and get people to think about them.
Yeah, I guess so. You know, whether it's through a video on the internet or an exhibition in a gallery, or, you know, they take different forms, workshops, etc. I guess the aim of all the projects are to really stimulate these discussions and to serve as kind of a space for this imagination and dialogue to begin. It's more getting an audience to ask questions than getting consumers to buy into a certain narrative.
You're using all these different forms, so museums or videos or exhibitions or whatever, to communicate your work. But why do you think this type of design is a good medium for communicating a subject like synthetic biology?
So we call this speculative design. One of the names for it is speculative design, just like speculative fiction in literature exists, and speculative architecture has been around for a while. So architects kind of looking at different options for urban planning, etc., without actually building the things. And so this is fairly new for design, and it opens up new ways for people to engage with the stories that we're telling, because we're telling them through a language that everyone recognizes as being the language of real objects or real products, etc. They're actually taken out of that context and put into another one, which is could be a fictional story or a different narrative. So I guess it's a kind of unique space to engage with the public in that way, because they can actually see proposals fleshed out and tangible in front of them, as opposed to, say, something that's more abstract, where, you know, in the media it's always about new research could cure cancer or could change the way we live, but it's never kind of made tangible, if that makes sense. So I guess that's where we as designers have this language of things that exist and that people can really relate to.
You do quite a few projects with your students. Have you got anything else going on?
Yeah, so actually, as a research associate, we're currently working on a wider kind of research project. The idea is to create a body of work. There are 7 projects in total, which all address this theme of synthetic biology in different ways. So the project is called Blueprints for the Unknown, and that's the kind of tension that we're looking at. So Blueprints is the engineering side. So the big promise of synthetic biology is that we'll be able to engineer life. And then the unknown is reflecting on the fact that life is random and mutates in all sorts of ways. It has its own agenda. And also that you can't predict what happens when science gets out of the lab. So it's really the tension between these all-controlling engineering logic and the randomness of life itself, but also of humans. So in the next few months, we'll be finishing these projects and hopefully having them exhibited.
What sort of things are you putting together?
So we're intersecting synthetic biology with another topic, again, to put things in context. So some projects are about a new kind of NHS, looking at insurance policy and what happens when you, for example, you have gene therapy and then you have children. Do you have to license? Do you have to pay a fee if your gene that you've paid for and is copyrighted gets passed on to your child? Another project is looking at how microbes could become a new form of currency. Other things are looking at the more aesthetic relationships that we have with nature and how we've been modifying it. And I'm personally looking at the environmental movement and kind of more political ideas around nature and what is natural, and very European opposition to GMOs, for example, and how that plays out on a more ideological level.
So exactly. How do you do this?
So balancing the entertainment value with scientific accuracy, you know, finding the right place between these two, have something engaging but also that reflects the real grounding in real research. So that's how we're doing it so far.
Okay, well, that's great. Great, well, thank you very much for speaking to me.
You're welcome.
This has been Julie Gould for The Pod Delusion.
Now, this week it was announced that Winston Churchill is going to be put on the £5 note, replacing Elizabeth Fry. I know what you're thinking. An aristocratic old white man replacing a woman. It's like cabinet reshuffle deja vu. Anyway, Marianne Baker isn't really on board with this, and in this next piece, she explains why.
Show me the money. What do you see? The Queen, perhaps? lots of anti-fraud measures like holograms and some images representing people whose work has made significant contributions to our progress. People we feel like honouring on our banknotes because of this. You may have heard that the Bank of England is proposing to replace Elizabeth Fry with Winston Churchill on our £5 notes. Fry was a prominent activist who pushed for social justice not only for women, but also other undervalued and exploited citizens like orphans and the mentally ill. If this replacement happens in 2016 as planned, it would leave no women on our banknotes. Now, I wasn't entirely convinced this was something worth looking at to begin with. But the more I read and the more little discussions I had, the more I feel it is relevant. I'm still interested in counter-arguments, though, and have already encountered some. As a bit of a tangent, it seems some people, mostly men if the tweets I've surveyed are anything to go by, find it necessary to point out that the Queen is a woman. Well, they are entirely missing the point. If I must explain, all of the people represented on our notes, apart from the current monarch, are there because of their achievements, their contributions to society and progress, not because they were born into a royal family. So let's focus on the real issue. At first glance, it might not seem like a huge problem. Our banknotes are redesigned periodically, mainly as an anti-fraud measure, but it's also nice to have a change now and then. Elizabeth Fry has been on £5 notes since 2002, and we had Florence Nightingale on £10 notes from 75 to 94. But they are the only two women ever to have featured on English banknotes, and replacing Fry will erase all acknowledgement of female achievement from them, unless one of the others is redesigned with a new female figure at the same time. On the 1st of May, BBC Radio 4's Women's Hour episode included an 8-minute discussion on the banknotes decision. Plenty of female candidates were put forward, that most people won't have heard of many of them, despite their amazing work. Beatrice Webb, for example, an economist and co-founder of the London School of Economics, is surely reason to increase the visibility of forgotten female influences in our history. I don't accept the argument that history has recorded men as the winners, therefore we should accurately represent that fact. Here and now, we are trying to create a more equal society, or at least some of us are, and part of that must be doing what we can to correct the mistakes of the past. I suppose this depends on one's opinion of what the notes and their designs are for. Personally, I don't think they're meant to be a history lesson, but rather tributes to people we'd like to remember as agents in creating the society we have now. I think we can acknowledge that sexism and misogyny are alive and well, even if it used to be much worse. So let's pull some of those suppressed achievements of women out of the dark and show them to people living and growing up now. Similar instances of projects just like this include the editathons, in which people have dedicated time to editing web pages in order to give due credit to women, for example in the history of science. A particularly famous example that most of us are aware of being Rosalind Franklin's contribution to the discovery of DNA. But it's not just women's contribution to science that are often hidden from us, but in all manner of fields, economics, engineering, literature. It is important for young women and men to realise that gender is not a barrier to achievement, despite what the history books might show. These little sexist acts build up, and while lacking female role models on banknotes may be a small thing in isolation, it's one of many that add together to give young people the message that women are underachieving and undeserving of recognition. Research has shown that increasing the visibility of female role models can improve confidence in women and girls, and combat that feeling that we all get from time to time, that we're imposters and don't belong, all the more damaging for women, often, given our history of oppression and strictly defined gender roles. I don't agree that striving to have at least one woman on our notes is overcompensating or being unfair to men. It's just giving some small recognition to the contributions of approximately half of past Britons that were systematically overlooked. Striving for something closer to equality instead of extreme pro-male bias, whether that bias be historically accurate or not, is simply pushing for equality. That's feminism. It's not asking for no men to be recognised, only for making a positive change that will address an imbalance. Our very own Liz Luckendorf pointed out to me that aside from the gender balance issue, there are other reasons we might object to putting Churchill in particular on our notes. It is argued that his policies caused the 1943 Bengal famine, which killed around 3 million Indians. I have also considered another comment I received. that if we're going for equality, we ought to represent everyone, and we simply don't have enough notes to do so. I'd probably argue that as we're talking about half the population here and not, say, less than 10%, this is at least the most obvious problem. I agree it would be good to address the all-white male lineup by including some ethnic minorities, for example. If there are obvious candidates, I'd certainly support that. Not all minority groups are outwardly visible, though. Perhaps at some point we could have the great computer scientist Alan Turing, whose tragic early death was a direct result of the persecution he suffered simply for being gay. But where do we stop in trying to be representative? Should we stop? Can we just put cats on all the money instead, please? The Guardian have picked up on the story and are running a poll on which women people would most like to see on a new note, which includes Mary Wollstonecraft, a great writer and women's rights campaigner. How about Ada Lovelace, the first computer programmer? If you would like to object to the removal of all female achievers from our banknotes, you can sign the change.org petition. I'm also interested to see people's comments on this, either here on the Pod Delusion or over on my blog post titled Battling Sexism. This is Marianne Baker, reporting for the Pod Delusion.
Now this week, over in Cardiff, which is in Wales, as I think the locals call it, Dean Burnett has been taking part in a big science event known as the Pythagorean Cabaret. Yes, Dean has put together this report, but has he got the right angle? Will he talk up the events that occurred? Hype up the news, as it were? Harry Potter news? Dean has been talking to all sides of the event and getting to the root of what it's all about. That reference works, doesn't it? Here's Dean, with more.
Hello, this is Dean Burnett. I'm currently backstage at Cardiff Museum for the second Pythagorean Cabaret. And not the catchiest title in the world, but it's not my idea. This is a cabaret night dedicated to science and amusement and stuff like that. I've done a few reports from these things before, and now I'm doing another one for James sends out his regular hysterical midweek, I haven't got enough stuff to fill the time, email. So I'm going to just talk about what's going on here. It's a bit like... It's a bit like the Uncaged Monkeys tour, except not as many famous people, unless you count me, which I don't. I'm going to count myself because I'm currently recording a piece for The Pod Delusion, which has a reasonably big audience, I'm reliably informed. So I'm going to talk to some of the people who are on tonight and see what they do in their day jobs and how they further the understanding of science and stuff like that. So from here on, let's go. Is that recording? Cool. Okay, hello, this is Chris North. Say hello, Chris.
Hello, Chris.
Very good. Okay, so you just did a talk about... but what did you just do a talk about?
It was sort of about space exploration and that kind of thing. That's the missions we've had to Mars and elsewhere over the past few decades.
Excellent, because you're a man of space. You're involved with the Sky at Night, aren't you?
I am. I'm one of the... one of the reporters is probably the appropriate phrase, but I'm one of the people who present Sky at Night.
I'll be honest, I tend to be in bed by the time it's on. Are you on the show a bunch, or are you actually...
Yeah. I'm on pretty much every month certainly a little bit.
You're actually in front of camera guy then.
Sorry,
you're actually in front of camera guy.
Oh yes, yeah, so I'm in front of the camera. One of our latest things we've launched that I'm doing is something called space surgery. So people can send in their questions and we try and answer them on screen, which is quite good. We've got a lot of questions sent in, so people can send their questions in at the website bbc.co.uk/skyatnight, of course, if they want to do that. And that's been good fun. We've got some great questions about that. People really have really interesting questions about what's going on, about just space, the universe, space missions, and even how to set up their telescope and this kind of stuff. So we're trying to answer as many of those as we can, and cool. It's all great stuff.
Excellent. And is this your full time job, or is that something else you do? You have a day job?
I have a day job. I only moonlight on the Sky Night.
Right. So
my day job is at Cardiff University, where I work on the Herschel Space Observatory, and this is where I get out the violin. Finished operations today. It ran out of its helium coolant, so the operational phase of the mission is now over. And the data analysis will continue for years to come. But I do some of the science behind that, some of the with one of the instruments, and I also do the public outreach for the UK. I coordinate that for the Herschel Space Observatory. Is the main day job?
I didn't know it was the last day of the Herschel day. We'll explain why you're wearing black. Yeah. I think before you came on, the host Priest introduced you as our version of Brian Cox. How do you feel about that as an accolade?
Well, I don't have the same accent.
No, is that the only difference?
No.
You were in D-Ream, you have the same level of female fans, but just the accent is...
True. No, there's a... it's easy to sort of be, what am I trying to say? It's easy to, I guess some people are jealous or whatever, of Brian Cox. He's done a fantastic work for popularisation of astronomy. He's very good at what he does. And he's the TV shows are very popular and lots of people watch them and they tend to explain things at a you know, perfect level. So it's, you know, I like to think the stuff he does and the stuff we try and do on Sky Not are very complimentary.
Yes. I never disagree with that. It's not in my field, so I wouldn't.
Yeah.
If I was inclined to do so, I wouldn't have the authority to do it. So that's why I wouldn't do that. But I'm just a colleague of yours and a friend of ours, Professor Coles, of course, did a talk once which he basically rubbished the entire universe to prove Brian Cox wrong.
Right.
It's not wonderful. It's full of nothing. It's rubbish. I think you've got to sort of think, I mean, his reputation maybe is getting a bit out of hand when some professors are willing to dismiss the whole of creation.
Well, there's a thing about Brian Cox as a particle physicist, but because a lot of his shows, certainly his early ones, were all about astronomy. Lots of astronomers saying, oh, but he's not an astronomer. Well, but he made good TV programs, and that's the, you know, that's the key.
Well, he just did, I'm a biologist, he just did Wonders of Life, so I've encountered that same argument myself. But I have no issue with the guy at all. So, thank you for that, Chris, that's great. So that's Chris, a proper astronomer on telly, on the BBC. So look out for him and go to the address he said. Thank you, Chris. Okay, I'm talking to Rosie Coates. Say hello, Rosie.
Hello, Rosie.
Yep, Chris made the exact same joke. It was just as funny then. okay, so you're a chemist. We've spoken before. Let's do it again, just for a recap.
Yep.
You're a chemist in what capacity? What do you do?
Well, I used to be a practicing chemist in that I did a PhD in chemistry and I was a computational chemist. yeah, not anymore. But I was a computational chemist. I worked in inorganic chemistry, trying to work out some of the structures of heavy metal complexes.
Well, cool, but you don't do that anymore.
I don't do that anymore. I am now a science communicator.
Ah, nice. So how is that different?
It's different in that I don't do any research, and I mostly am going into schools and developing science shows for delivery in schools and then delivering those science shows in schools. That's what we mostly do. And those are schools, primary schools and secondary schools, so going right from four-year-olds right up to 18-year-olds.
Oh, cool, so you've got a full range of them.
Full range of science shows, yeah.
Which one's easier to talk to, if it's worth asking? Or they all have their own intrinsic...
They all have their own...
properties.
Yes, absolutely. But I would say primary school probably it's easier in a primary school to come away feeling loved, but it's harder to be confident that you've got a science message across. So they have the relative merits and pitfalls. You can more often be confident that you've got some good science across that's curriculum linked, all that kind of thing for secondary schools, but you don't necessarily have that feel good feeling that everyone there loved me.
Yes.
So in primary school's pretty much the
same. Oh, that's nice then.
Yes.
Cool. Any particular horror stories of working in schools?
I've mostly got away relatively unscathed from most of my experiences. I don't think I've got any real horror stories.
Oh, good. That's nice then. I don't go to schools, judge says I can't. But I will say that, you know, of course, we've done this event once before in this museum building, and it was an all-male bill. We had some complaints about there not being enough women on to represent, which is, of course, a very valid point. So you're one of the female contributors tonight.
I am.
You just baked on stage. I'm going to say that's not really helping the stereotype.
You could be right. I didn't really think about that when I was doing it, when I was planning it, I must be honest.
To clarify, you made a meringue on stage.
I did make a meringue rather than actually baking a cake on stage, which would have been quite boring.
Yeah.
Although maybe not. But what I was really trying to do was to do a little bit of real life chemistry, and it just happens that I like eating. I don't mind a bit of baking, but actually I like eating a lot, and so that's really all I wanted to do.
That's
I'm not sure if I need to break every stereotype.
No. You just hear, that's fine. You know, a woman doing science, I mean, that's outrageous enough.
That's pretty revolutionary, yeah.
You can't challenge people all in one go. You know, you've got to give them something.
So gently, kittens and cakes to start with, and then we can move on to, you know, quantum mechanics.
I think the worst part is, someone listening to this will probably think I'm being deathly serious about this as well. And in fact, you'll agree.
Me too, yeah.
It's going to be quite... yeah, so we probably should stop it there. Well, thank you, Rosie, for your time.
Thanks very much, Steve.
Okay, I'm stood here with Rhys Phillips. Say hello, Rhys.
Hello, Rhys.
Everyone's made that joke so far. It's not been funny once. Marvellous. Nothing personal, of course. And, different names.
If you've been asking everyone to say hello, Rhys, then...
Yeah, well, that's my fault then, really.
Yes.
So, but I haven't been doing that. Just
good for you.
Right, good. We've talked before, we'll talk again. So you're a guy who researches lightning. You can control lightning, essentially.
I wouldn't, Once I can control lightning, we can make lightning in a lab.
That's pretty good.
Sort of Frankenstein-esque. Hmm. But that's not what I'm talking about tonight. That's the real job is researching lightning and its effect on aeroplanes and how we protect against any damage.
Yeah, basically, because you're the guy who sets up all these nights, Pythagorean cabaret and various other engagement events, and you're a keen science communicator.
I am indeed.
You have your radio show about this as well.
I do. It's Pythagoras' Trousers. It's where the name Pythagorean Cavalry came from. Mm. And, and you're a frequent guest on the show.
Frequent guest. If I could find someone better, I would. But
we've tried.
Yes, we have. But I think it's, of course, you're a keen science communicator. I mean, in my perspective, I would have thought if I could make lightning, I would just sit back and wait for people to come to me. But no, you go out there and engage with people, don't you?
I'm lucky because it's one of those jobs that you don't have to work hard to make interesting. It sounds interesting as it is.
It does, yes, and I'll give you that. But also, you're a keen member of the IET.
I am indeed.
Do you tell people who the IET are?
Yes. Some people don't. So the IET are the Institution of Engineering and Technology, and basically they're the professional body for engineers to sign up to in the UK for professional development, for becoming professionally registered, so becoming a chartered engineer, for example, you have to be a member of some sort of professional body. It's equivalent to the Institute of Physics for physicists or the Royal Society of Chemistry for chemists.
Excellent. Do you feel engineers are underrepresented in the general field of science communication at present? I've heard people say such things.
I think that there are some very good science communicators who are engineers. We've had some of them perform in the cabaret in the past, but there's not as many of them out there doing it as people who call themselves scientists doing it. But weirdly, you still get people who are scientists doing science communication, but then covering engineering topics. You don't seem to get as much of it the other way around.
I mean, I would argue perhaps that is because engineers obviously doing actual stuff which needs doing, and publish a theory and then sit back. Oh, you deal with it.
Well, you said those words.
I did say it. I will say it again to anyone who dares to ask me. So, any plans for the future regarding cabarets and performances?
The idea is that the cabaret will be roughly an annual event in Cardiff, aiming for sort of one within each year of activity within the IET. Hopefully we'll be able to tour this version, this sort of Mark II version of the cabaret, to some other places around the UK, like we did with the first cabaret. There's a lot of people involved in this who are involved in things like Cardiff Science Festival, so a lot of the same people are currently working together. And in fact, it was you who called us all together in the first place to instigate that a couple of years ago.
And then it just wandered off.
And then you just wandered off and left us to fend for ourselves.
Yes, I thought, I've done my part. I had the idea. And like a scientist.
You're the ideas man.
You deal with it, yes. I've had the theory, so that's the important part. And then, just one last question. You're a keen science communicator and organiser of these events. You're also a keen jazz man.
I am.
Any intentions to combine the two?
Well, I did think of trying to do a sort of a science communication talk on the theory of improvisation and maybe analysing the different sort of note progressions that are commonly accepted within jazz solos. But so far, it just sounds like an awful lot of work. Haven't been bothered so far, if I'm honest with you, Gene.
Fair enough, yeah.
It's much simpler to keep those two wheels separate than try and bring them in some sort of hybrid formula.
Well, I will ask, because I don't know anything about music. When you see the people do those jazz sessions, is that improvised or is that all...?
Yeah, it depends. I mean, generally, the way a jazz session or an open mic night works is that you'd have a tune written on a bit of paper, everyone plays through the tune, and then those who want to improvise and take a solo will go around the room soloing. And some of those people will genuinely be making it up differently every time. Some people will know the tune well enough that maybe they've got a way that they do a solo for that particular tune and they'll use it. But yeah, generally that's improvisation.
Yeah. This is why I don't know anything about music. I haven't got a clue how that works. But my last question, how do you know the song's over?
Well, it depends. Sometimes you generally don't, until someone in the rhythm section, so the drummer or the pianist, sort of gives some sort of signal, right, we're going into the last verse, and everyone plays the tune again. Sometimes at the very start, someone will say, right, we're going to... It'll be so... Bob, Alice and Craig will each do a solo, and then we go back into the tune, or... It really does vary, but sometimes you generally don't know if it's over or not.
Cool. Sounds completely unscientific, and...
and that's what I love about it.
Excellent. Cool. Thank you, Reese. Thanks for your time.
No problem.
Okay, I'm here with Dr. Mark Looney.
Looney? Yeah, just straight.
Yeah. And you just played a rather impressive version of Bohemian Rhapsody on the electric guitar.
My version called Bohemian Rhapsody after David Bohm, the quantum physicist.
Of course, Quantum Bohemian Rhapsody, the best kind. I mean, again, no one would disagree with that.
Well, it could be good and rubbish at the same time, exactly. And no one could argue.
Exactly, all bases covered, that's fine. Yeah, cool. Your day job, what would you say that
my
is?
I'm a patent examiner. I work in the patent office in Newport, looking at new inventions in telecoms. So, when Apple try and get $1 billion off Samsung or whatever, that's kind of basically my fault.
Nice.
But all the customers who screwed one way or the other, that's my fault.
All right, cool. So we found the guy, everyone.
It's me.
Kind of recording this on my smartphone, so if something explodes, I think it knows who its master is, yeah. But you seem to have a, you obviously have a good knowledge of the physics of acoustics. And
I am. My PhD is in acoustics that I did in Cardiff University.
Mm-hmm.
And then went to Newport to become a civil servant. Thought about academia, then thought twice.
Yeah, that seems to be the way it's going at the moment. I think I got there early. It's not like you have ideas before they're popular, like someone who would steal patents. I'm not that's what you do. I'm just saying that's a possibility that suddenly occurring to me. Cool. Any plans for the next? You're doing FameLab soon, you said?
No, I've done that. I was the first winner of FameLab in 2005.
Wow.
So I'm yesterday's man in that respect. I'm trying to get into a bit of writing. Got some musical things I'd like to do. And I'm doing a show called Are We Made of Maths? Around the country at various things like Maths Inspiration, Gifted and Talented conferences. I'll be doing it probably about 25 times this year.
Nice.
So I'm sure I'll be in one or the other city.
Yeah, just like... Okay, do you want to tell everyone your Twitter account so they can track you if you want, or...?
Just Dr. Looney. L-E-W-N-E-Y.
That's what I say, yeah.
It's
the
weird spelling.
Not the
tunes. I'm not trying to pretend I'm not tunes, but that's just how it is. It's Manx, I believe.
Ah, fair enough. Cool. Thank you very much, Dr. Mark Looney.
Cheers.
So there you have it. That's the Pythagorean Cabaret covered for another year. Hopefully it'll be coming soon to a town near you, wherever you happen to be. I'm not in charge of the tour schedule, I can't really tell you any of that. But look out for it. I've been Dean Manette for the Pod Delusion yet again.
And that's just about it for the Pod Delusion this week. Please check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen back to over 3.5 years of podcast archives. Also on our website, you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter and all that sort of thing. And whilst you're on our website, please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. We really appreciate all the donations and they help us pay the server bills and keep making the show week in, week out. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Tessa Kendall, Chris Chapman, Dean Burnett, Naomi Wilcox, Drew Ray, Alex Brown, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz Luckendorf. The Sketch in the Moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Oh, thanks. Thought I'd only ask for crisps.
No, I mean, what's your stance?
Well, it's kind of hunched over with a face like an orangutan sucking a lemon.
Oh, that's far too much information. No, in the news this week, it says that porn isn't all bad for you. What do you think?
Well, it's not all bad, no. I've got this link to a brilliant website.
Oh, will you take this seriously? There's a debate going on that porn might not be bad for you.
Well, it's bad for you. You barely leave the house Monday to Wednesday. You only go out on Thursday because the wife needs the broadband for her foxy bingo. What's the argument?
They reckon that proper use of pornography can even up the balance in a marriage, where people have different sex drives.
What, have you and the wife,
Well, yeah. We've got totally different sex drives. My good lady, you know, she likes it twice a week, and my sex drive is up the A42 to that dogging site, just outside the church.
Why is it always by the church?
That's because the vicar's only got a push bike, and he likes to be back for evensong.
But surely most pornography creates an unrealistic expectation of sex that can lead to confusion and dissatisfaction.
Oh, you're telling me. I mean, like, last week I booked a repairman to come to fix my dishwasher. Do you know, you wouldn't believe what he did.
What?
Well, he fixed the dishwasher. Limescale problem, apparently. He needed a new pump.
Well, I can see where you got confused. And what about the argument that the porn industry is a business all about the money anyway? So accuracy or helpful advice is bypassed for instant gratification.
Oh, yeah, it is about the money, but that's no bad thing. I mean, I get nectar points with my porn provider. I'm just a bit embarrassed as to where to swipe the card.
Well, I can see the pros and cons. Oi, oi, lunch break's over. Back to it then, lads.
Fair enough. And starting positions.
And action.
I'm here to deliver the pizza you ordered.
I've been waiting for you. I hope it's hot and meaty.
It is, and covered with cheese.